loved it. I'll send you a copy. Bam! Bitch went down.
Welcome back to Horror Queers. We are talking British countryside. We're talking zombies as metaphors. We're talking lots of face makeup. I'm Joe.
And I'm Trace. And we are joined today by a special guest. David, are you over there?
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
David, would you like to give yourself a brief introduction so people know who you are?
Sure. So I've been writing for a good 5 years now. I was started writing for Movie Pilot in Berlin, and now I'm working as a freelancer in Austria, writing for a bunch of places like Heist Nobiety, Digital Spy, New Now Next, and I'm super excited to be here. Thank you, guys.
Thank you for having. Thank you for coming. it's still early. I'm good.
We figured it would make sense to bring a Brit on to talk about a British television show. So
yeah, there are some extreme Britishisms, I think. I was wondering if you guys were fully understanding the random phrases and bits. Like, were there any bits that you were struggling with or that were just odd?
I don't remember being any like particularly confused by anything. But I mean, it... Yeah, no, I don't know. Maybe something will come up and I'll be like, oh yeah, I don't remember that. I was mostly just trying to absorb this world, which was a fascinating world.
Yes, and maybe at this point we should probably mention we are talking about the television series In the Flesh, which ran on BBC Three for 2 years. We're talking about just the first series, though, so the first three episodes.
Yes, and for some reason, listeners, if you're like, what the fuck, TV show? Yeah, three episodes, all of them are available either on Amazon Prime or Hulu. I'm sure there's other places too, but those are obviously the easiest places to get it. So, and it's actually, the combined runtime is like 2 hours and 48 minutes. So it's like watching a really long movie.
So suck it up.
Yes. Suck it up. And yeah, it premiered on March 17th, 2013. The second season aired in 2014 and it did not get renewed for, I'm sorry, a third series.
See, Trace is already struggling. Wait, what the fuck's a series?
I know. No. Like when I was like first, like trying to like get into British television, but like, you know, learning about it, I remember being like series, like, cause again, for Americans, series is the culmination of all the seasons. It's combined.
Of course. Yeah,
it's
yeah.
The entire run.
So yeah, when someone's like, oh, like series one, it's like, wait, what? So I mean, and I don't understand why it has to be like that. Like, first of all, who decided first, like who named it first? British Brits or Americans?
Probably the Queen. Probably some British involved.
Okay,
I don't know.
So us Americans should have just called it a series. But you know, whatever. We just have to be different, apparently.
Yes, we firmly established. We've already talked about this with your metric system.
Oh yeah,
the Americans are just weird. You guys have to do your own thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's silly, but anyway, well, okay, well, so I mean, luckily because this is a TV show, there's no box office information to talk about, but I will say just for viewership, and I don't know how this compares for like how it tracks with other British television shows, but the episodes viewership, you know, the first episode had a 668,000 viewership. Episode 2 dropped significantly to 392,000. And then the third episode popped back up to 525,000. So it did a little bit better for the finale. Reception.
I was a bit confused by that because, like, why does everyone come back for the third one and miss the middle? Like, that was quite a key segment, I felt.
You know, and I'm trying to think of the time period because, I mean, Hulu was around in 2013. I don't know if this was on Hulu back then, though. But, you know, it's normal for a second episode to drop off pretty significantly after the pilot because, you know, everyone is curious, checks in. And obviously, this is a very unique show. So, you know, like people maybe just were interested. But yeah, the fact that that third episode had such a big bounce back. But also because typically finales get a bump in ratings too.
Yeah.
But then it's like three episodes, you know? So I'm not used to those really short seasons.
Yeah. Whereas in the UK, a three-episode series, a 5-6-episode series, this is commonplace. This is part of the financial model that they use for making television. So three episodes is not unusual, whereas here in North America, this would be considered a mini-series, right?
Right. And well, and I was looking because the second series has 6 episodes and it was called an extended series. And I'm like, oh, because that would still be considered a mini series in America.
For us, it's like a marathon. Yeah, it was.
I mean, I remember when like FX started doing 13 episode seasons and it was like, well, I mean, I guess no, because HBO, like, really, they stuck with, like, you know, 10 to 13 episode seasons, and then FX kind of, like, mimicked that when they started doing Nip Tuck and stuff, original programming. But it was very weird, you know? It's like, what? It's not 24 episodes? And now, you know, 24 episode seasons are just, like, not as popular as they used to be.
Oh, gosh, yeah. You could count on one hand how many we have, but I mean, this is just the difference in funding models, I find.
Yeah, absolutely. So, a reception of the show, and I went with a reception for just the first season. Second season, both of them were very, very, very highly regarded, but the second season was a little bit better rated.
Oh, really?
But, well, okay, but the first season has a Rotten Tomatoes score of 94%. The second season has 100%. So, I mean, like, you know, it's a difference, but that could be, like, one or two reviews, you know?
That's interesting. But David, the audience... Have you seen both series?
I have, but I watched the second one when it first came out, so my memory's a bit hazy on it. But I do remember thinking it was better actually. I feel because the six episodes, it gave them more time to flesh it out, and no pun intended. And I feel as I realized that I said it, and also just the new characters, and I felt like they'd already really established that universe. You know, like, which is quite often for these kind of shows anyway. You know, that's how it works. But yeah, but that's not to say the first one's not strong.
The first season's pretty contained into, like, its own world, and so I can imagine that we want to expand it in the second season, but it works that you don't remember it that well, since, I mean, obviously, people that are listening, I'm assuming, probably did not continue to watch the second series, but maybe I'm wrong. Also, I'm going to be using season and series interchangeably. I'm so sorry, guys. It's really hard to adjust to that.
It's fine. Yeah, story of my life.
Mapping your brain.
And yeah, so audiences loved it too. You got an audience score of 97% on Rotten Tomatoes. And then Joe, your favorite, Metacritic, score of 76 out of 100 with an audience score of 8.1 out of 10.
Okay. So not bad.
No, I mean, people really, really dug it.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, it's funny as well, because when it first came out, people were a bit resistant, because it came out on BBC Three, which was like a side channel no one really cared about as much, and it replaced another show in a different time slot that had just been cancelled called Being Human, which was super popular, so there was a bit of resentment. Yeah, do you know Being Human?
Yeah, I've never seen it, but they remade that on Sci-Fi for America.
Oh yeah, of course.
No, I was actually surprised, because when I was going through the cast list trying to pull, you know, some of their past roles, I was shocked at how many of them. I was like, oh, I know that show, but then I was like, oh, it's the British version, like the original, because us Americans literally copy everything.
Sure. You do love to remake, yeah.
It's pretty insane. And yeah, I mean, and luckily, also, I was kind of worried about going through, like, the crew for this episode, this series. See, okay, wait. you call the first season a series, so what is the show itself called? Just a show?
Yeah. Either a show, or, I mean, you can also use series for the whole bit, which is just unnecessarily confusing, but, yeah, yes. They're kind of interchangeable, to be honest. I think we didn't figure our shit out in time, and that's how it worked out.
Yeah, sure. But luckily, the director, the same person directed all three episodes, and the same team wrote all three episodes. Johnny Campbell directed them, and he's done quite a bit of TV, but his most notable thing since this was the adaptation of J.K. Rowling's The Casual Vacancy, which I believe was an HBO miniseries, or maybe it was BBC. I'm not really sure.
It was both. Okay. So it was made for the BBC, and then it gets picked up by HBO, which is what AMC and HBO both frequently do now. So they co-partner, and then there's a bit of a delay between when it airs in the UK and then when it airs in the US.
Right. But then, like, something like Killing Eve or, like, Orphan Black, like, those are all BBC. Oh, it's BBC America. Which,
yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Confuses it even more now. Yeah.
But just to clarify, so Orphan Black was actually airing on BBC Three at the exact same time as In the Flesh, or at least within the same year.
Yeah.
But I guess the Orphan Black kind of, you know, took off more in America, which is why it went on for, what, five seasons? Four seasons?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, the show was created by Dominic Mitchell, who, this is really the only thing he's done, but he wrote all three episodes with Arthur T. Manderly. Mitchell, the only thing he's really done is written an episode of Westworld, which was also directed by director Johnny Campbell. And then Arthur Manderly, he's done a bunch of TV, but this is one of those ones that was remade in America. He did Red Band Society, which was remade in America with Octavia Spencer and lasted for like 10 episodes.
I don't even think it lasted that long, did it?
No, it was 13 episodes. It aired 10 and was pulled from the schedule.
There we go.
Well, I haven't even heard of it, to be honest.
It's a treacly, like, sick kids in the hospital, make a makeshift family kind of thing.
Yeah, and Octavia Spencer was, like, the Nurse Ratched of the show, but, like, she was, like, you know, had a heart of gold or something. I don't know. It was, like, right after The Help came out, so, like, she was kind of at the top of her game.
Okay. The good Ratched.
A shitty yeah. television show.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I haven't seen it, so I don't know, but clearly no one else wanted to. Yeah, and, I mean, again, I don't want to go through, like, really the whole cast, but, I mean, really just, like, you know, your main players are Luke Newberry as our protagonist, Kieran, Emily Becken, who is my favorite, as Amy.
Yes.
Yes, so good.
She's fantastic, and she's also in The Casual Vacancy, by the way. And then Harriet Kanes as Kieran's sister, Jem, and David Walmsley as Kieran's lover slash best friend, Rick. So, Joe, I'm intrigued to what your plot synopsis is. Like, how long is this thing?
Okay, so I've cheated, and I just stole the episode synopses from Wikipedia. So it's about the same length it normally is.
Yeah, those are short. I read those as I was watching the episodes.
Yeah, so they'll mostly cover what people need to know in case they have not. Though we should clarify, as always, we are spoiling. So if you have not watched the first series, we'd encourage you to go and do so now. As Trey said, it's under 3 hours, so really, it's just like watching a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in the flesh, here we go. So episode one, Kieran Walker, one of thousands of individuals affected by partially deceased syndrome, or PDS, returns home to Roarton. He has been subjected to months of rehabilitation and medication at a special defended unit specifically designed to keep the PDS sufferers in. The government has set an agenda of acceptance and tolerance. However, a cauldron of brutal anti-Rotter sentiment exists and is gathering support, especially within the church, and it persists among the Human Volunteer Forces, HVF, a self-designated militia created to patrol the North during the Rising that refuses to disband. So that's a very broad overview of episode one, which is really just introducing the characters and sending Kieran home to deal with some not so thinly veiled racism, homophobia stuff.
Yeah.
Episode two, Kieran feels trapped at home and escapes to his grave, where he is reunited with his old hunting partner, Amy Dyer, who persuades him to take a dangerous day trip. He discovers that Rick, his best friend, who he had a romantic interest in and thought was killed by an IED in Afghanistan, is back in town, so he visits him at the local pub. After an awkward reunion, Kieran finds himself on a hunting mission in the woods with members of the HVF, where the night patrol has reported live, rabid rotters roaming free. Kieran persuades them to hand the rotters in for a reward rather than kill them. And finally, episode three, which wraps everything up. Kieran visits the supermarket where he used to hunt, which brings back memories of when Jem spared his life. The siblings then confront their past issues and drop in to see the Lancasters, parents of the girl he killed. Kieran begins to feel better, but must say goodbye to Amy, who is leaving Roarton in search of the undead prophet, who is kind of like a zombie messiah that posts videos on the internet. At the end of the episode, tragedy strikes Kieran after Bill kills Rick. So Bill is the leader at the HVF. Rick is Kieran's lover, claiming he is not the real Rick and leaving the body leaning against Kieran's garage. Kieran storms in to confront Bill, but ultimately leaves, and Bill is then shot by Ken Burton, whose PDS-afflicted wife was murdered by Bill at the end of the first episode, which, to whoever wrote the synopses, you maybe could have put that in the description of the first episode.
I know.
It's kind of significant. So that is your very loose plot summary. Because this is a television show, of course, we have quite a bit more than this. This really leans into the plot, whereas I would argue that the show leans into a lot more of the emotional character-based drama. So
yeah, and there's also a couple more subplots. Like I mean, which I'm gonna try to avoid like predicting what happened in the second series, but you know, there's like a burgeoning romance between Philip and Amy that, you know, is kind of introduced.
Mm-hmm. Philip is a city councilor who appears sympathetic to the PDS sufferers, but then is also responsible for like tagging their houses.
Yes. Yeah, oh, yeah.
Now,
I will say, so the first episode, I mean, is the weakest of the three to me, but I think it's because it has to do so much to get you into this world.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of heavy lifting.
It is. Sure. And I definitely liked every episode, like, more and more as they went on.
Yeah, it doesn't hurt that episode two introduces Amy, who is, honest to God, the life of the fucking party.
Like, yeah.
She is, I think, by far the most energetic and enthusiastic character on the entire series. So it's like when she gets introduced, you're like, oh, okay, it's not just going to be dour English people dealing with a bunch of repressed feelings. Which, no offense, David. I'm sure Brits are lovely.
How dour are you?
on a scale, depends. Well, I feel like some people might not like to hear this, but the further north you get, maybe the more dour it gets. But I say that coming from the south. So,
but that's actually kind of a hilariously apropos comment, because I think it's really significant that this series is set in the north part of the country.
Absolutely. But it's a fake town, right?
Yeah, it's fake. But yeah, I do think it's interesting, because I think they even mention that in the first episode. I think there's a throwaway line about the way the zombies have been reintroduced into society was because of the Southerners, and like we were blamed mm-hmm. for this soft approach, I suppose.
And the HVF also had to, like, they're self-created by the locals because they are so isolated in the north that apparently the government more or less didn't help them during the rising, so they had to create this militia to patrol and provide their own safety, which is, I think, one of the reasons why they now refuse to disband.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, obviously, and then there's all that symbolism anyway of that kind of small town phobia and resentment anyway, and I think it's the perfect setting to kind of build that up.
Which, that's interesting. It's like the British North is kind of similar to the American South, because the Southern states, you know, your Texas, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, Alabama, like, they're the ones that are known for being the less liberal of the, you know, areas of the U.S. Or I guess really the Midwest too, that's kind of in there. But the South, you know, is like, I mean, Civil War.
Yeah,
I mean, so I guess one of the things that we should probably clarify right off the top is that this is a series that is built on a fairly obvious metaphor, and like zombieism equals homosexuality for quite a bit of this. And then, of course, the HVF, I think you can fairly easily associate with things like the people who still have Confederate flags or Nazism and that kind of stuff.
Well, the allegory or metaphor is very on the nose for a lot of this. Like, I mean, it's like super obvious, but you can really plug in any quote unquote other for homosexuality. Now, of course, since Kieran and Rick are gay, that obviously plugs in easier, and since all of us are queer, we are plugging that in. But I mean, you could plug in any kind of minority or other group. I mean, this also like goes back to Nazism in the 1940s.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons why this series either does or does not work for people is because the metaphor for zombies and homosexuality is so obvious. Like, I think we're often used to having to project a social or political message onto zombies, because they're, I mean, that's one of the reasons why zombies have lasted so long as monsters, because right. you can really just kind of plug anything into them, depending on, you know, oh, okay, we've got zombies in a mall, now we're talking about capitalism and consumerism. Mm. We've got, you know, a black man facing off against zombies, we've got race-related issues and so mm-hmm. on. So obviously Romero was kind of the master at introducing some of this, but you can go back all the way to, you know, voodoo, Haitian kind of things that were happening back in the 50s and 40s. So there's a long historical legacy of it.
I actually look, because, you know, obviously, like, the zombie subgenre it's a really easy way to, like, you know, inject social commentary. But luckily, hopefully, some of our listeners, I don't think, so this is, like, kind of not related, but kind of, I was reading, like, comments on Bloody Disgusting's Ma review, and someone was commenting, like, I'm so happy they, you know, did this with a black woman, and they didn't do any unnecessary social commentary. It's just, oh, like, that would God. Just ruin the movie. Wow. And I'm like, you're, just so fucking stupid.
Oh, yeah. The rabbit hole. I think to me, that's one of the reasons why I'm so attracted to this particular text, is because it's that much more, I hesitate to say accessible, but it's a little bit more obvious. So I think it doesn't have to spend its time dancing around the fact that this is what it's trying to do. And it can then just embrace that and use it to its storytelling advantage.
Mm-hmm. I was literally about to basically say the same thing. I think it's refreshing in a way that it's more brazen and more explicit in a way with its queerness, because like you say, normally we're projecting ourselves into these situations. So I think it's actually really important that they can tackle that, and then you don't have to skirt around the issue, and there's, it's less interpretation, more what's the meaning behind this.
So I'm curious to hear, I mean, partially Trace, I want to hear your thoughts because you're the only one of us who has not seen this before.
Right.
As attentive listeners will recall, I name dropped wanting to do this episode way back in the very first episode in speed dating. So Trace, you said you wanted to do Jennifer's Body, and that was our third episode. Mm-hmm. And I said I wanted to do In the Flesh, and here we are, like, in the upper 20s.
So, okay, I confess, and I'm going to sound like a huge douchebag for this. So first, when you're like, TV shows, like, oh, fuck, I don't want to watch a whole season of a whole series of a TV show. And because I didn't know it was three episodes. And then I also, and again, this is going to make me sound really small-minded, I thought it was going to be foreign. And so, and I have watched, like, I watched The Returned, which could also, you know, or I'm sorry, Les Revenants, which could be compared to this in, on mm-hmm. a kind of similar level. But it was kind of one of those, was like, oh, I don't like want to have to watch a whole foreign series of TV, of a TV show in a week. So it was very much like, I don't think we're going to be able to do that. But then, of course, you know, when I saw, oh, A, it's British, and I know that makes me seem small-minded, like, nope. I have no problem with subtitles. But again, like, in my mind, I was thinking it was going to be 13 subtitled episodes. And so I was like, that's just a lot to ask of me and to ask of our listeners. Right. So, but again, knowing what it is now, it's like, yeah, okay, like, I was being too judgmental.
Okay, so now that you've seen all three of these episodes, what are your thoughts?
No, I mean, like, I'm not as enamored with it as you two are. And I think maybe, though, like, that might be, like, because I probably need to watch the second series, which is, you know, just six episodes. But I do like it a lot. I'm interested, though, so because I've seen, you know, Les Revenants, I've seen The Cured, the Ellen Page zombie movie that's basically kind of cribbed this idea.
Yeah, for sure. I was going to say, yeah, we might have to dedicate a whole section to that.
Well, and so I'm wondering if I would have felt differently about it had I seen it first. It's very much, you know, like when you have, you know, younger viewers and they're like, oh, well, like, the original is really boring. And it's like, well, you have to kind of look at it through that time period of when it came out because people hadn't seen anything like this before. So even though, like, the remake or something that's, like, you know, like, cribbing from it might be more entertaining to you, it's not, definitely not as original, which makes it slightly less impressive. So,
right.
I mean, I did like this show. That first episode did take me a bit because I don't love Kieran as a protagonist. I think he's a bit
bland.
Yeah, he's a little bland. I mean, like, I honestly, any of the other characters, like, I was more invested in, you know, Rick's stuff with his dad, anything with Amy. I kind of hated Jem too, though. She was a huge cunt and I really had an issue.
Like, well, particularly in the first episode, right?
Yes. Well, because she's introduced, like, you know, the rebellious daughter who, like, doesn't talk to her parents. And then, of course, when Kieran comes in, like, you know, she doesn't accept him. And obviously that's explained later as to why that is the case. Like, there's, like, a very specific instance that Kieran doesn't remember, but it was very hard to get into it. I loved Shirley, who's Philip's mom, who, like, oh, you know, yeah,
the nurse who administers the treatment and
she was great.
Everybody.
She deserves a spinoff for sure.
Oh, 100%. And obviously, even though I don't like Bill, I was fascinated by the interactions with his son and his denial of his PDS status. Like, that was, and even when Rick dies, like, that scene when Kieran confronts him, which finally I was like, oh good, Kieran's doing something that I care about. That's awesome. When he basically says, you know, that wasn't Rick, he's going to come back when, you know, Jesus resurrects all the dead. it's so good. I really, really enjoyed that.
I can imagine that people who have had difficulty with their family as part of their coming out process may, I hesitate to say feel triggered, but this is probably going to raise some uncomfortable feelings because, I mean, Trace, you and I have talked about our coming out and how, mm-hmm. all things considered, we didn't have a very hard time of it in terms of the grand scale.
And yeah, grand scale. Like, I mean, we definitely had issues with parents and, like, you know, whatever. But it wasn't like, you know, there was no disownment happening.
And I think to me, one of the things that I really enjoy about the show is the relationship between Bill, who is, you know, this gruff, kind of old-fashioned, masculine, you know, I've got my gun, I'm organizing this posse, and he feels like his worldview is very much rigid and defined, and the reintroduction of his son, who is both gay and a zombie, which he seems unable to process either one of them. And yeah, whether you want to say it's like he can't process one because of the other, or he just refuses to process both is, I mean, I think we can have a conversation about that. But I love this idea that, you know, it's not just that his son comes back and he's like, oh, my dead gay son is back. He's also like, oh, my son is gay and dead, and I would rather kill him than have to process either of those two things.
Yeah, and dude, I mean, I know this is like the very end of the episode, like the series, but I felt like Bill was gonna kill him, but I love that they didn't show it. And the reveal of, like, you know, his body up against Kieran's garage is really, really heartbreaking. Like, I almost cried a little bit whenever that happened.
That was a savage moment for sure.
It was bad.
And also when the mum realizes, well, her husband's dead.
Yes,
that was dark.
That was a breakdown. For
well,
sure.
It was so frustrating though, because I actually think that, I mean, you know, I think, and David, you can maybe comment on this because we don't know really what your coming out story was, but you know, I feel like a lot of male queer people probably had an easier time coming out to their mom than their dad, and that dynamic between the mom, how she just wouldn't say anything to that dad, and like mm-hmm. she was cool with Rick, just happy he was back, but like whenever the dad did something or was like obviously like in denial, she wouldn't do anything. And it's just tragic because it's like, I mean, you know, even though Bill does kill Rick, it, you know, it's kind of mirrors, you know, if someone, a gay teenager, committed suicide, and like it would take that to get someone to wake up,
which also happens in this series.
Yes.
And though the way she's almost always to the end, even, she's still quite subservient to her husband. You know, I was quite shocked rewatching it when she was bringing him a beer as mm-hmm. the confrontation was happening, and I was like,
yes,
this isn't really the time. Like, I get the need for alcohol, but like, yeah, it's so sad to watch her be that broken.
The eye acting when she realizes what has happened, like, it's just, oh, it's crushing.
Yeah. I kind of loved all the mums as well in different ways. I think all the mums had great moments. You know, like in the first episode of Kieran's mum when she whacks out the chainsaw suddenly.
Oh my gosh, yes.
That was, it was a bit surreal at first. It seemed a bit out of character, but I felt like as you got to know her in subsequent episodes, it kind of rang more true, hopefully, especially because they've all been through the uprising. You know, I guess it's easy to forget that they've actually lived through an apocalypse already, but we just haven't seen it.
Well, okay. I'm trying not to make us dance around too much, but I think to me that was the other thing that I initially really gravitated to, is I had never seen a TV show or a movie that dealt with zombies after the fact. Like, everything always wants to talk to you about, this is what it's like at the beginning when it's chaos and nobody knows what the fuck is going on and is the army coming. So the idea that we more or less parachute into this world years after the fact, and the show dares to explore how would society rebuild? Because, I mean, I think we always like to think that something could be solved and you could resume some sort of normalcy. Mm-hmm. And the show argues for the fact that, like, this world has been completely upended and there's no going back. It's the people who struggle, who are unwilling to bend and recognize the new world, who have the most struggle and who end up committing the most violence.
Well, and I wonder, because I it's been on for like 10 fucking years, but because The Walking Dead, I think, started 3 years before this. I think it was like a 2010 start. So I wonder if the like smash success of that show helped this one get made, even though that show is still, even after 10 years, very much a standard like post-apocalyptic zombie world. And this takes a much more unique approach to it.
I think it definitely helped because BBC Three, the channel it first aired on, was actually, they didn't have a big budget. They didn't have many original shows at all, actually. I think I read, I don't know if that's true, but I read they would only have one drama at a time. They would have more comedies because it was bigger hits. But
well, and I think that's one of the reasons, it's one of the reasons that this show got canceled, is because I think they did have more than a few, but then their budget got slashed in the second season of the show. Oh, so in 2014. And then that's when they pulled the plug on the show. So it's not because it didn't have good ratings or because it didn't have the critical acclaim, but because they were like, we're broke.
Yeah, it got nominated for a BAFTA as well, I think. The British TV Award. So yeah, it was doing really well, I think.
And a GLAAD Media Award.
Oh yeah, did it win in the end? Was it just nominated? I can't remember.
No, it was just nominated. I don't think it won. But, I mean, you know, it's not surprising considering the subject matter.
Yeah, and it's pretty good for a British show to hop over 5 years ago, I think.
Yeah.
Pretty proud.
Well, okay, so I know you said you didn't want to like dance around Joe, but you know, I mean, we can jump into this Cure discussion now, and it doesn't have to be too long, but, and listeners, if you don't know, The Cured, I want to say it's 2016, but it's a movie with Ellen Page where it's almost the exact same concept, where zombies, you know, it's years after that happened, and they've discovered a cure that can revert zombies back to a, like, basically a human state, and they're being reintegrated back into society. And Ellen Page has a son, and her husband was killed by a zombie in the outbreak, and her husband's brother, so her ex-brother-in-law, was a zombie and comes back to live with her and her son as she, like, she helps him get, you know, rehabilitated back into society. I don't know if we want to kind of spoil the, like, the kind of emotional reveal of the movie.
Let's just say that there's obviously more to the relationship, and it's Ellen Page is not the main character.
It's the brother,
but he has the same kind of trauma that Kieran has, where he remembers what he did as a zombie and he has a lot of guilt about it. And there's obviously an emotional catharsis. And I guess the other big thing about that film is that he is friends with another person that he was in the system with, and that person feels very disgruntled about the way that he's being treated, because he used to be a barrister, which is a lawyer for people who don't speak British. And
yeah, I didn't know that.
But he can't get a job above a janitorial staff, and he ends up getting involved in a rebellion. And there's a suggestion, or people have read, that there is a homosexual inclination between more so the barrister and the main character.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, sorry. I was going to say this.
No, go ahead.
Because you haven't seen the second season yet. I don't want to spoil too much if you're interested. But
yeah,
actually, some of the themes in the second season, I think, play an even more important role in The Cured, as it were. I feel like The Cured took a lot from season two, which was even more frustrating for me to watch The Cured then.
Yeah, I really struggled. I ended up reviewing The Cured because it played here at TIFF. And so I reviewed it for Bloody, and I basically had to spend the entire review, like, I think I opened by saying, if you've seen In the Flesh, you've already seen The Cured. And then I had to just, like, put it aside because I was so frustrated. Because, and again, I'm doing that thing where I look at conventional reviews from places like Variety. Variety panned In the Flesh and said that it was stilted and not interesting, and it was just too kind of subdued. And then they gave a, not quite a rave, but they gave a very enthusiastic review to The Cure, saying that it felt fresh and it was really innovative. And I was just like, Variety,
God damn it,
you are fucking idiots. Like, I feel like they shouldn't be allowed to review genre in general.
Yeah, I feel like you always mention that Variety whenever you're bringing up genre, especially like indie or like smaller scale genre filmmaking. But that is something that I was going to say, that was like, yeah, the rebellion plot that's introduced in the first series of In the Flesh. And they have the drug that, you know, like, it's like a cocaine drug that makes them go like zombie-ish again.
Yeah.
It's introduced in the first episode and not, it's like mentioned again later when Kieran's on the internet, but then it's really dropped. So I'm assuming that comes into play in the second series.
In a big way.
That's the entire second series.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
But that's interesting though, because, I mean, again, I'm speculating. Did they know they were going to get a second series? Did they? Because this one does work as a contained story. And if you remove the rebellion plot, it feels even more contained.
I feel like they probably did, just because, like, yeah, there was elements like that, and also I feel like Amy in particular, I felt like there was planting seeds for more. I can't actually confirm that, yeah.
I got the impression it was one of those, like, we're going to lay these kernels, and if/when we get a second series, then we'll be able to pay them off in a bigger way.
Yeah.
And you kind of use it as the through line to say, like, hey, BBC Three, you should definitely pick us up for another series because we've got a lot more ideas to work with.
Well, and that is how people should do TV shows. I hate it when, like, it, because again, like, it's getting renewed, at least in America, I don't know how it is for Britain, but it's not a sure thing like it used to be anymore, because like ratings, like there's so many factors when determining ratings. And I hate it when a show that's like on the bubble, when they end it with a major cliffhanger, and I'm like, that, don't fuck your audience that way. Do what this show did, plant seeds and say, hey, like, you know, these are things we can expand on, because this one, like, I mean, you can see where it could continue, but it's a satisfying ending for this series.
Yeah. Whereas if you had have ended the series with something along the lines of Kieran discovering Rick's body and then him just storming off, and it'd be like, ooh, what's going to happen? Or, you know, it would have been so unsatisfying, right?
100%.
I wanted to mention, I actually read the same Variety review as you did. And because, I was interested to see what the American perspective was. And yeah, it kind of pissed me off because it said something like, Walking Dead this ain't, and I was like, isn't that the whole fucking point? Like, I was like, it's not trying to be The Walking Dead in any shape or form, and yet that was the obvious lazy comparison, so that was pretty frustrating. Well,
and I was going to say, too, well, wasn't The Cured British, but The Cured is Irish, so yes. It's still not American, but it's, I mean, they knew what The Cured was. They had to. Oh,
for sure. Closer to home.
Even in the Variety review of The Cured, though, they talk about how it may not satisfy people who are expecting, you know, high-octane action, and they're clearly talking about things like The Walking Dead still. I think what's happened is that since the advent of fast zombies or running zombies from 28 Days Later, there's now this assumption that every zombie movie will be that, or the Dawn of the Dead remake, or The Walking Dead, where, you know, it's constant peril and it doesn't really matter what you do, it's an action film with these monsters.
And that's what's so interesting to me, because like zombies have never been my favorite subgenre, be it, I mean, and I like the Romero, well, some of the Romero films I like Snyder's remake. I like 28 Weeks Later more than I like 28 Days Later, which might be
too.
Yay. but okay, but Joe, so that's what's interesting though, because 28 Weeks Later is undeniably more of a typical zombie film than 28 Days Later, which is more of like a drama.
Yeah, I would actually put 28 Days Later in league with something like In the Flesh and The Cured, because it's far more interested in the societal implications than the actual rage virus people.
Right. But it's fascinating to me that this comes out, and I mean, again, like this series got 94% of Rotten Tomatoes, so I guess Variety is like the one negative review that it got.
They're not even negative. They're just, they're missing the point.
Yeah. But like, you know, what this comes out, which is a very, very, very fresh take on the zombie subgenre, like, say what you will about how it's executed, I guess, but just the concept of it, to say it's like not good or not, you know, interesting or fascinating or whatever.
Yeah, not exciting enough.
But yeah, that just means like, okay, like, so you don't watch zombie things ever, apparently, or you've just seen The Walking Dead.
I'm World War Z. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like your cultural cue is, okay, what is the lowest common denominator that I can reference? Which does make sense, right? If you're thinking about writing, and we're all writers, so we know that sometimes you're kind of told, oh, don't go for the obscure reference, go for something that every reader is going to be able to understand, right?
Right.
But I think that really diminishes the impact and the intelligence that In the Flesh has, where they're saying, yeah, we know that you've got a general idea about what zombies are and what they do, but then they're introducing ideas like, how would they be cured? How would they be, like the makeup and the contacts. To me, the very first time I watched this, it was so fucking genius. It's visually fascinating, but it's also just a really easy narrative idea to say, okay, these people look fucking dead, but you've got to somehow find a way to reassure regular people that things are okay. So it's like the surface veneer, like really the whole series is about people putting on appearances that they're okay or not okay with the current state of the world. And then you've got this visual fucking reminder that is just so obvious, but yet people are like, oh no, like just put on some concealer and some contacts and you're completely fine. Like, it's so smart.
I mean, it ties into that whole, you know, particularly for gay people, if you're trying to pass, say, in straight society. Mm-hmm, so it's that physically passing manifest, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Like, are you mask? Yes, girl.
Yes, put my contacts in.
No, but like, it's like, you know, and I even still meet some people today, like some other queer people who like behave in a completely different way when they're, say, at a gay bar than when they are, you know, just like out in the general public.
Yeah, it's all about doing what you can to either fit in or stand out. And I think that's one of the reasons why Amy is such a dynamic character in the series, right? Because she is unabashedly unafraid of stepping out, but it also ends up coming back to hurt her, right? Like she has that relationship with Philip, and it seems sweet, and then it turns toxic, and then she gets more or less sexually assaulted in her own home just for daring to be who she is.
Yeah, that was dark. But I mean, I still find a very inspiring character, the way she, I know she had that moment when she was thinking about leaving, but she still ends up becoming, like you say, the force for change. Especially, and also in season two, more so, but I don't want to go into that. But
yeah, she has a big arc that pays off very nicely in season
two. And you can see the seeds are sown absolutely in season one for that.
And then one of my favorite sequences is that scene in the, I think the second episode, when her and Kieran go to the pub, and she just displays her, you know, uniqueness and, you know, essentially rebellion. Just being like, fuck you guys, I'm gonna come here. What's the cheapest drink you have? Like milk or orange juice or something? She goes, two of those. Love it.
Oh, yeah, lemonades, that was it. Yeah, yeah.
Lemonades, yes.
And she's like going au naturel.
Which is funny because it's such a contrast to like what everybody else is doing at that bar, right? Like that is clearly the local watering hole where all of the town drunks are just congregating and
from opening.
She's
onwards,
like,
yeah.
Hi, I'm going to come in here and I'm going to get a fucking lemonade. Like you could not get a drink that's more distinct and different.
Well, and she can't even drink it. Like she's,
no.
She
can't.
I also love the scene where I think again, it's in the second episode when they go to that fun fair. Well, I say yeah. fun fair, but yeah. it's pretty basic, but you know, when they're on that ride and they're spinning around and she's talking about smashing the clock and not being afraid of death. And, it's really fascinating to see the psychological impact as well of like living for your own death and then coming back and actually how mm-hmm. freeing that is. I guess, again, metaphorically dealing, perhaps it's facing and dealing with your own insecurities and your own otherness, no matter what that might be.
And can you imagine having like being self-aware enough to say, I know that I'm different. Like, I know that I'm undead and people are afraid of me because I represent their literal worst fear.
Yeah.
And still having to be able to process and live your life in some way.
She feels like the queerest character in a way, even though she's not actually LGBTQ at all.
No, 100%.
Just that catalyst for change, you know?
Mm-hmm. She's the activist.
Yeah. That carnival scene is, I mean, her introduction's in the cemetery, but like that carnival scene is like her next scene. And that's kind of your big like, oh, it's so refreshing coming off that first episode with Kieran as like, you know, the centerpiece. And then you get this other character who is such like a polar opposite of what he's like. It really injects a necessary life into the show that first episode was lacking.
And it's important that she gets introduced in the same episode as Rick. So if mm-hmm. we're starting to pivot towards Rick, like Amy is this dynamic, vibrant, true to herself, you know, absolutely queer icon. And then you've got Rick, who is totally mask, totally closeted, bro hey to the max. Like, you know, I love the fact that he is a... He died in service and mm-hmm. part of that regimented, systematic, you know, formulaic thing that he's plugged into, which is, it makes so much sense for the character that he would bow to his father's will because of all of the things that he's had in the past. But then I love it because he's a very different representation of not just zombieism. Like we've got Kieran, who's your sort of bland, unassuming, maybe a little bit fey. And then you've got Amy, who's your vibrant, bright, true to herself. And then Rick is that in between. Like the three of them form a very, very interesting triad.
Yeah. I was going to say tripod, but triad definitely makes more sense.
Tripod, something different.
Yeah, the way he suppresses himself, I guess because of his father and his own internal hatred, is a marked contrast. I thought it was quite funny with all the posters of women in his room as well, and the dad's constant flirting with her mate, and like... It was. I think that probably feels quite real, you know.
No, that's the interesting thing is because like even though you know the zombieism is like the literal thing on display here, there is still queerness in it. But Rick is the only character that really has to deal with rejection on both fronts, both being a zombie and a PDS infected
sufferer,
and being gay. But it was really the scene when he's vomiting the black vomit in the urinal of that pub that I was like, oh fuck, like, and it really. Because again, trying to stay closeted and being, you know, like hiding who you are is torturous on the inside. You know, it's you literally just can't be yourself. And watching him vomit that stuff up is such a good physical manifestation of that, like, torture that you feel.
I love the fact that it's just to prove how out of sorts he is and how he doesn't fit into the regimented boxes is that he's also not even vomiting into a toilet. He's vomiting into the urinal, which is like not the right way to do it. Like you're not fitting in.
Yeah. And it's going everywhere. I was like, oh God, I hate to be a janitor in that place.
I mean, it didn't look the cleanest in the first place, but yes, that was definitely not.
Rick seems to be even in denial of his homosexuality. And it's just like, it's such a frustrating watch, but like you, as anyone who's ever been in that situation, you can understand it.
Yeah, yeah, we've all known a Rick. Maybe some of us have been a Rick.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. What did you think about... I was really interested in the way they don't really show the queerness. You know, there's no real affection between the characters because they're trying to hide it. In season two, it changes, I would say. But in season one, it's still very much just verbal. I wonder, what did you guys think about that?
I mean, again, this is talking about going expectations going in. Because, you know, all I knew was, oh, it's a gay zombie show. So I was like, okay, cool. I definitely expected the gayness to be a little bit more explicit, so when it wasn't, I was not taken aback, but I was surprised. But I think that makes it easier to digest for hetero audiences, because obviously anytime you show, you know, queer intimacy, queer actual physical sex, it's, you know, some people can handle it, others, like, even if they're accepting of, you know, us,
you're gonna lose an audience potentially.
Yes. And so, and I don't know if maybe that was why they made that deliberate creative choice or not, but it makes sense to me. And I don't think the show needed any kind of, you know, well, it didn't need like the graphic sexuality. However, yeah, I would have liked to have seen like a couple kisses or two.
Yeah, to me, I expected it to go this way, if only because when you meet Rick, it's so obvious that he's not willing to accept certain things about himself that I couldn't imagine him giving in to any kind of affection. So I think the closest that I really felt any kind of intimacy is when they're in the car in the second episode en route to the quarry to potentially deal with the escape dangerous rotters. And you really start to get a sense of what their relationship was like before everything happened. But it does feel like a chaste, almost. I mean, it's hard to remember, too, that they're meant to be teenagers. Like, Kieran is supposed to be 17 years old.
I mean, people are fucking at 17.
In England, yeah.
Well, I mean, in America, people are fucking at 17. But
but it feels often very childlike. Like, I saw one review where they compared Kieran to Peter Pan. And I was like, yes.
Oh, like a stunted, like,
yeah,
child.
Yeah, like, he's almost like a child, like he's a baby in the way that, and I don't want to suggest that that's one of the contributing factors to why he ended up committing suicide, because I do think that, A, there's a bit of a danger in saying like, oh, if you're more obviously queer presenting, life is going to be harder for you and you're far more likely to consider suicide. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think that that's true. I think people struggle with things in different ways, but I liked that Kieran is, at the end of the day, he's a little bit more creative, he's a little bit more introverted, he's a little bit more pretty, like he's not quite masculine, because I think there's a lot of us, and I'm gonna put myself into that box as well, that we're not like super butch guys, like we're not masculine. I couldn't hide my queerness.
I can't
from
either.
People like when I came out, people were like, yeah, girl, what took you so long?
Yeah.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I hate that.
So I resonate with Kieran for that reason. Like, he feels like a very real person to me. And then with Rick, I flip the opposite way and I'm just like, why can't you be softer like Kieran? Because at the end of the day, I don't know, it's hard to feel things for Rick because he seems so adamant about not accepting who he is.
Okay, so maybe y'all can, because I'm gonna admit something here, and maybe y'all can relate or maybe you won't, but there's definitely like, so I came out when I was 16, and there's definitely like a lot of people I knew, like friends or acquaintances, came out after high school, mm-hmm. and I felt like such like a, not rage, but such like a fucking like, Why couldn't you do that with me? So I wasn't the only one.
Why did you leave me to hang and be the poster child?
Yeah, resentment, you know? And so even still, when I see someone who's like in their 30s and they're still like closeted, it sounds so mean because it's like, you know, you're not them. Everyone has to come out in their own time. But there is a certain resentment where I'm like, I just wish that, you know, you could do this. But obviously, you know, if I stop to think about it, it's like, well, you know, it's a very personal thing to come out. And it takes a lot of, you know, I don't want to say bravery because it's like, then it makes it sound like I'm saying that these people aren't brave for like not coming out, but Yeah, for me, coming out at such a young-ish age, although I guess now that you have fucking kids coming out when they're like 10, which is so foreign to me.
Same.
But I mean, yeah, I remember, like, you know, going to a high school reunion, and I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, god damn it. But it's a personal thing, so.
Well, I get that frustration. One of my best friends didn't come out to me until many, many, many years after I came out to him. But he was like, oh, I knew at the time. And I was like, why didn't you tell me at the time? That would have been a much nicer experience. But like you say, it's very subjective and it's very personal. So it's funny with Rick, because like you do see the influence in his life too, though, you know. So I did feel sympathetic to a point, but it was still frustrating. It was like, you clearly like Kieran very much. Just fucking get on with it a bit, you know?
And like, when his life is in danger, maybe don't just leave him a phone call and hope for the best.
Yeah. Like, from a phone box as well. I love that.
Okay, so if y'all want to move on from Rick, I actually would like to talk about Jem. I thought it was an odd choice. Not odd, maybe, but like that they made her a female. Because if we're going for this, like, you know, queer allegory here, and maybe it's different, but I feel like, you know, a lot of times for a gay man to come out a teenager, it's usually like if someone's going to have a problem with it, it's typically a brother, as opposed to a sister who might be more understanding. But that's also, I'm like putting my own experiences on that.
But isn't that more refreshing in a way as well, that they did do that with a woman, with a sister? You know, like, it was like the fact it's unexpected, because some of the storylines are, how do I say, not obvious, but you know, they follow a certain clear trope and a clear path. So like, by subverting it in that way,
on the nose.
Yeah, exactly. So by subverting it in that way, it keeps it a bit fresher, perhaps. Maybe that's why.
Well, I didn't really feel like she had an issue with his queerness. You know, I think part of it is that the storytelling for Jem is kind of backwards compared to everybody else, where it's more or less going forwards. Like, with Jem, she starts off and she seems very abrasive and very confrontational. And it's only in that third episode where you really find out, oh, she's not doing this because of any sort of circumstance. It's because of what she saw in the supermarket where Karen killed her best friend. And, you know, she's dealing with her own PTSD and her own grief about the role that she played in not stopping him. And I love the fact that grief and guilt is introduced in nearly all of the characters, but for completely different reasons and in completely different ways. But I guess with Jem, it's interesting because she starts off so completely unlikable. Like, in that first episode, she's just fucking unbearable.
She is the worst.
And you don't really understand why, but like a lot of the storylines, like the whole series, this first series, is so well crafted that everything ends up getting paid off in that third episode, where you finally get the resolution.
I like that they resolve their conflict. I also love the scene when they go to the parents of the girl that he killed, and they're just like, oh, that's great, because that means she's going to be alive.
Heartbreaking.
It's grim.
Because you think that they're going to get it, and you think that they're actually okay with it, and that it's going to appease Kieran of his guilt, and instead it just adds a different kind of layer.
And Jem is the only one that reads the room correctly, and she's like, oh yeah, it's possible.
And the moral is, never reveal your secrets.
Exactly. They either get you killed or they just cause further trauma.
Denial.
What did you two think that this all takes place in a relatively isolated, small community? Because the big thing with The Cured is that it obviously takes place in a big city, and that's more or less, like, we often end up seeing zombie scenarios taking place in big metropolitan areas, and then, you know, people hunker down in a house or a mall or something like that. Whereas this is like, they get to play with this whole town, but it's still relatively isolated.
A house or a mall. Okay, so Night of the Living Dead or Dawn of the Dead. That's basically what you're going with there.
Or like a research facility, or, you know, in Walking Dead, they always end up finding like a little town with a gate that ends up being breached at the end of every season.
Well,
I stopped watching Walking Dead in season 3, so.
Well, I kind of love that, because to me it kind of tapped in. It was much easier to bring in the whole bigotry side of it, you know, because obviously there's that element more in small towns anyway. And then I guess everyone was banding together against the zombies in the uprising. So it kind of forged this bond for them. And I also think the way they did it in that sense, they brought in the religious aspect was really key. And I feel like that's much of a bigger thing in small towns, you know, but everything revolves around the church and your local pastor and all those activities. So I felt like every scene there was a cross in the background or there was a priest.
Well, I do love that at the end of the day, the vicar ends up being really the one who gets Rick killed. I mean, that's being a bit facetious because obviously he's not the one who commits the crime, but it's him suggesting that for no reason at all, there's something else, you know? Like, this show, I think, is actually very hard on religion. It's very dismissive of the controlling and manipulative abilities of the church.
Yeah, like the dad actively was telling the vicar, oh, preach a barnstormer, get him to, you know, rally against him again. It was very manipulative.
Yeah, get my son all fired up to kill his gay lover. You're just like, what the fuck?
Actually, well, I mean, because that could also be why the viewership dropped in the second episode. You know, if like, because obviously if like someone is like devoutly Christian and they see something that is rather hard on organized religion, like they probably like won't want to go with it again. Was this show, David, you may have a better idea, but was it marketed as queer or was it marketed more of like, oh, it's zombies?
As far as I remember, I think it was much more about the zombies because, you know, the concept itself is so strong. So I felt they didn't, they probably didn't feel the need. I mean, I might be wrong, but that's, I think I was surprised at the time, you know.
I mean, without knowing, like, you know, the general consensus in the UK of, you know, like the queer lifestyle, like, you know, if I could imagine maybe people went into this watching, you know, for zombies and then like when queer elements were introduced and it kind of seemed like that was going to be the angle they were taking. And also because, again, even in that first episode, you can see how it clearly mirrors, you know, mainstream public opinion of the queer lifestyle that they might have been like, oh, nope, not for me.
I'm curious, did you two identify Kieran as a queer man or when did that happen for you?
I honestly, had you not told me it's a gay zombie show, I probably wouldn't have gotten it that early.
Yeah, I don't think it hit me straight away either. I feel like maybe, you know, when certain characters you kind of feel like you might relate to more, or you just feel, but you don't necessarily think they're actually going to turn out to be explicitly queer. Yeah, I think that was kind of it for me.
Yeah, because I feel like it took me almost into the second episode, because I remember being really emotionally devastated when it's revealed that he killed himself. Because then I was like, oh, wow, we are doing not just a queer storyline, but a queer storyline in a small town with bigotry. And we're talking about a 17-year-old who goes into a cave and killed himself. And then, of course, again, we get that really big emotional payoff where the mom finds him in the cave in the third episode. Yeah. And then the dad talks about discovering his body. And it's just, I'm not going to lie, definitely cried during the mom scene this most recent time.
Sure.
It's rough. It's rough. And yeah, I mean, I don't feel qualified to really talk about teen suicide, but we obviously have to talk about this because it is a big issue that faces, well, teenagers in general, but especially queer ones.
I mean, we're recording this in Pride Month, which is, you know, the celebration of all things queer life and hopefully getting people to a place where they can love themselves and build their community and whatever form that takes. But the very real fact is places like Rorden exist and they have, you know, these vulnerable at-risk, not just queer youth, but maybe just queer people in general. And I think the series is really brave for addressing the fact that Rick dies in an IED explosion, and that's something that happens, and Kieran dies by committing suicide, and that's also something that happened.
And like, it didn't explicitly necessarily link the suicide to him being gay in any obvious way. I mean, obviously it's inferred and implied, and I think that was kind of brave too, in a way.
Okay, so, and maybe I'll read it differently, because it definitely reads as, okay, he was upset that Rick left him, and that is pretty much like the catalyst for him committing suicide.
But it's not him being gay. Like, he's not saying, oh, I'm gay and I can't be this way, and he kills himself. He's saying he feels left and abandoned and alone.
Exactly. It's like part of his identity. It's part of a number of issues, I think, he felt, being isolated in that town anyway, because the town was shit.
But I can see, you know, how any criticism of, like, what was something that just happened? Like in Game of Thrones, when, you know, a certain character took a drastic dark turn that seemed at a character because her boyfriend broke up with her. You know, they're like, well, that's really, like, stupid because, oh, she can't have a man and she goes crazy. So I could see how someone might read this, though, and be like, okay, well, so he killed himself because his pseudo-boyfriend, like, left him.
Which I think is what happens, but that's also something that is real, right?
Yeah.
I mean, especially if you think about, like, we don't meet any other explicitly coded queer characters in this town. Like, we're meant to believe that potentially these are the only two. And so if you lose 50% of the queer population in this really isolated northern town, like, that would take a toll for sure.
Yeah, like, when he broke down, he was very much blaming him. And like you said, you left me alone. You know, there was that whole college talk.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, that oppressive atmosphere, not atmosphere, you know, the oppressive kind of regime almost of the town definitely plays a factor, for sure.
I liked that conversation in the car between them and how Rick didn't know. He didn't know, like, until he told him, basically. I liked that.
Well, I think because you're meant to infer that Kieran's letters were being intercepted by Bill or potentially by the military. So that it's another layer of not just miscommunication between the two of them and how they're just not connecting in the way that, you know, they could, and it would make their lives so much better. But the fact that their destinies were effectively being controlled by systems or people that were designed to keep them apart.
I do like, too, that it's not, because a tendency with media to portray suicide, like, in a narrative, like, situation, it can tend to get suicide porny.
This was no 13 Reasons Why.
I was like, it's not like 13 Reasons Why, which, admittedly, I do like that show, but I'm fully aware of its problems. Fully aware of
it. Same.
And so, yeah, this one I thought handled the subject matter very delicately and respectfully.
It's interesting, too, because the genre opportunities allow them to open up the dialogue about the impact of suicide with the person who technically shouldn't be involved in that discussion, right? Mm-hmm. Like, by having Kieran be a zombie, he can actually come back and have to face that. And it's tricky. Like, I love the scene with the mom because I think it does play to the sensibilities of the relationships that gay men have with their mothers often. Mm-hmm. And that one was the one that really got me. But seeing the dad really break down and talk about what it was like to discover him and to hold him in his arms and have Kieran be able to apologize because it's always dangerous to blame people who commit suicide by calling them selfish or not thinking about the impact that it would have on the people that they left behind. But it's, I think, also encouraging to say, you know what, it will affect everybody. Like, because it's so hard when you're struggling with mental illness that you can't see outside of your own experience. So being able to address that and have that family come to catharsis and, I don't know, like, I thought it was really... It was an emotional through line that paid off really, really well for me, particularly since the mom and the dad aren't hugely significant characters. Like, you don't get too much of them.
Well, and, you know, that's why there's a stigma on mental illness, though, is because people are incapable of putting themselves... Because, I mean, you know, like, I know several people that suffer from depression, and I've never suffered from it, so it's hard for me to understand what that feels like. And I feel like anyone who's never suffered from any kind of mental illness... They are so unwilling to try to put themselves in the shoes or even imagine what that would feel like, which is why people with mental illness, like, are afraid to be open about it, which is why when you see celebrities come out about their situation, it's so refreshing.
Which I think the show is also doing a decent job of addressing. Like, it doesn't really spell it out, but you definitely get the impression that there is something really wrong with Bill. To me, he's almost the most interesting character on the show because he's just so repressed and in denial about absolutely everything. And yet he has the strongest strength of his convictions of anyone on the entire series.
Well, and you know what he reminded me of was, y'all seen American Beauty, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Chris Cooper character in American Beauty who, you know, is clearly a repressed homosexual and, like, can't deal with it. And they never really addressed that with Bill, but I could see that easily being a reading.
I mean, yeah, and that's how the hypocrisy can play into that as well, because he's so desperate to deny himself in every facet. Like, when he runs into the pub and he's like, pints all around, and everyone's like, not saying a thing. There's definitely that extra layer.
I fucking said pints all around.
He's like, all right, mate. People are just quiet, yeah. But I wonder, was he in the second season at all? The dad? I don't really remember. Do you
Gosh, I can't remember. I feel like he and the wife aren't around.
He can't be around unless he like gets Oh, but that would have been a good avenue to take, though, if he got resurrected.
Well, but they clarify that it's... That was one of the interesting things about the zombie lore in this series, is that it only affected people up to a certain point.
Right.
Like, that's why the Lancasters have so much difficulty processing what's happened to their daughter, like what Kieran did to... I think her name's Lisa.
Because, yeah, he killed her after, like, the zombies stopped rising.
Which I think is also very interesting, right? Because typically zombie lore tells that, you know, once it begins, everybody can become a zombie. Everybody can be reanimated.
Well, then you're really dealing with an issue with overpopulation.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess that was necessary to, like, otherwise they're fucked.
I can see why they wouldn't include the mother in the second series if they don't, but it would have been an interesting avenue to take. However, if it expands on the world as much as y'all are saying it does, I can see, like, you know, she might not fit into the equation as much.
Yeah, I will say, if people enjoyed this first series, I personally don't find the second series quite as compelling, just because it does broaden the scope into more political realm. Mm. But I will say that if you enjoyed this first series, it is worth checking out the second one, if only because the quote-unquote villain of the second series is so hissably hateable. Like, I live to hate her. It's a black woman who comes to town. She's a politician, and she has very strong ideas about how the PDS people should be handled. And then, of course, Kieran gets a new love interest who is far more also politically motivated because he's involved with the Undead Prophet. So that stuff with the experimental drug, the zombie guy who's on the website who's talking about, you know, instilling rebellion, and then this new politician woman really brings everything to a head. I can't remember, though, David, does that second series kind of end on a cliffhanger? I remember thinking, like, oh, I can't wait to watch the third series, and then being very pissed off.
It kind of does. It's one of those weird ones where you're like, oh, you can see that there's a huge seed, but like... It's also, if you want to see that as the ending, it still works. Personally, I think. Yeah. But like, it was a bit frustrating regardless. I was like, give me season three. But
I know. I was trying to think of like, what's the show that ended recently? Oh, actually, oh, another zombie show. Fucking Santa Clarita Diet. Like,
oh, I love that show. Like,
I know. And fuck Netflix for canceling it. Because, I mean, it kind of works, I guess, as a series finale. But it's definitely a cliffhanger. So it's like, god damn it. Ugh.
Actually, yeah, when I think about it, In the Flesh is a bit like that, to be honest. You're like, yeah, you're like, give me more, give me more, but okay, it's kind of an ending. All right, fine.
Yeah.
It's almost more frustrating when you can see the potential. Like, I mean, that's one of the reasons why, at the end of the day, it's hilarious because I do podcasts, two different podcasts about movies, but my heart is really, like, I'm a television guy because I love the capacity for... you know, character building and world building, and the opportunity to say, okay, we've put a pin on this story, but there's so much more that we're going to tell you in successive seasons or series.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I think one of the reasons for me that In the Flesh works as well as it does is because you get to spend more time. Like, if you watch The Cured, it feels fucking rushed as hell. Like, it is frantic to try to introduce this premise, give you compelling characters, build up relationships, you know. The acceleration with which the rebellion, like the zombie rebellion that happens in that film, it's so fast that you're just like, grr.
I ended up giving that movie a 3 out of 5 because it was one of those where I was like, okay, it's fine. And I think had that movie left out the rebellion, it would have been better. If it was just a contained story between these two people, I guess three if you count the kid, like that would have been more interesting and you could devote more time to it. I get the need to do the rebellion because that then goes into more like standard zombie territory as they uprise.
It's the bombastic conflict that you need to get people excited.
Yeah. But yeah, there's not enough time and like what I'm assuming is probably a 100 minute movie, maybe more, maybe less, to, you know, put all that in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a bit much. I mean, and I assume a sequel isn't on the cards ever either.
No, I doubt it.
Yeah. I don't think it did very well. It never really got a wide release, though. So
I mean, yeah, I saw it at Fantastic Fest, but it did get I think it was like a VOD release.
But I mean, if you're going to rob from In the Flesh, you know, fair enough, I guess.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's still a really cool concept. And I mean, like, you know, if we get fucking something else out of it. I mean, hell, if America remade this show, I'd watch it just to see. I mean, also because any kind of remake, I'm from like, you know, foreign to domestic, it's I'm always interested to see like how they adapt the cultural, like the specific cultural parts of it, which is also why Joe and I, you've discussed like how sometimes like the J-horror stuff doesn't translate very well, because so much of those are inherently Asian or Japanese. Like, it doesn't work over here. But I feel like from Britain to America, it wouldn't be quite as crazy.
Yeah. And yet the number of failed adaptations in the US of UK properties is really quite high.
Yeah.
Yeah. Within the Flesh, I a lot of it is kind of, there is a British element to it. I don't know. I can't really...
Yeah.
Obviously, but like, I mean, in its core, I mean, like, and I can't really pinpoint necessarily why it's, except that northern setting in particular and that small town vibe. Mm-hmm. Maybe because I'm from the UK, but it really resonates. Oh, yeah. Like, just feel like I know that kind of place, even if I didn't live there myself. So yeah, I mean, right. I don't think it'd be impossible to remake in America, but I think it would be really interesting to see if the core of it can carry over. You know, there's so many little bits, like even there's a bit I noticed when Jem's walking and they're talking about white lightning and like drinking these big bottles of cider, and he just took me back to when I was like,
oh, yeah,
too young and doing the same thing, and like, yeah, on, like on the beach. Yeah.
But that's the thing though, whenever you're doing a remake like that, I feel like the ones that are less successful are the ones that try to hold on to those like very specific, you know, culturally things, true, true, because they don't work over here. So if you're gonna do that, you have to really make it like completely, not completely different, but like lose those aspects and try to make it your own. It's same if someone in Britain was, you know, remaking something for America, you know, like you'd have to get rid of the whatever, like the Americanness of it to fit your culture.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
It was interesting, David. So you may or may not have heard it, because Trace and I did a Patreon episode on The Curse of La Llorona.
Oh yeah.
And we ended up having this big discussion about just how poorly it's not an adaptation, obviously, of another film, but it's an adaptation of a Mexican folklore. And right. The mistake that they make is that they just set it in the most blandly generic-looking Los Angeles neighborhood. And you're like, why would they not have given this its own distinct character? Like, set it in a place that makes sense. Yeah. And I think that's one of the dangers that they do, right? Is like, if this was remade in the US, I think we'd end up in, it'd be like some Twin Peaksian kind of Northwest.
No, see, and I think it would be a Southern state. I really think it would be a Southern state, but the La Llorona comparison is not quite the same though, because that is a Mexican folklore tale. You can't make that American, which is what that movie kind of tries to do. But it's like in our Fatal Frame episode, you know, we talked about, you know, The Grudge and how that was, well, The Ring was actually very successful because like that aspect of The Ring wasn't inherently Japanese, so you could translate that to America. Whereas with The Grudge, like the idea of that curse is inherently Japanese, so they have to put Sarah Michelle Gellar's character in Japan as like the ignorant white lady. Mm-hmm. But
which I maintain still kind of works, and I'm hopeful that we can maybe talk about that if the new Grudge movie ever
comes out. So I get it. I mean, it's obviously a thin line, like when adapting, like because you don't want to appropriate the culture, you don't want to insult the culture, you don't want to completely ignore the culture. But I mean, and that's why it's hard to do something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's interesting between like America and the UK as well, because they're more similar. I think in some ways, right, it makes it actually harder because. Yeah. I feel like either way, they feel like, oh, we can pretty much do a straight remake because we are similar. But actually, no, there are key elements necessarily that aren't. Yeah. Whereas hopefully, at least with the Japanese or the Mexican ones, at least you would hope that they would try to acknowledge the difference more. But
well, I mean, and, like, that's why I would argue, like, what helps The Grudge remake is that it's at least set in Japan. So, like, there's that.
Well, I think the other big thing is the language, right? Like, that's why the assumption is that properties between the UK and North America can translate easily is because we're all speaking the same language, which of course is not at all really true, because even things like if In the Flesh was remade, you wouldn't call them rotters. Like, that to me is so distinctively British.
For sure. And I love the aspect. I mean, I don't love the term, but I love the aspect of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and y'all say series instead of season. It's madness. Pandemonium.
I can barely understand it.
Well, I mean, Joe, even with like Canada and America, I mean, I'm sorry, Canada and the United States, because obviously Canada's part of North America. Canada and the U.S. is more similar than the U.S. and Britain, but there are still distinct differences between the two cultures.
Yeah, I mean, this is why we have things like national cinema, or we have, you know, people who claim to hail from like certain parts even of individual countries. Like, I feel like people could watch In the Flesh and you could miss the fact that they say that they're from the North, or that they're a small town in the North, and still really, I think you could still understand everything that's happening. But I do think that if like people who are from the UK who identify as either being from the North or the South are going to, they're going to get a little bit more from that distinction. Like, it's not just a small town. It's a small town in the North. And that means something different, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It definitely adds another layer. I think if it'd been set in the South, obviously the South, there's also small villages and ignorance and all those themes. But yeah, there is something intrinsically Northern about that that is instantly identifiable, I think, to anyone British.
Well, I think, David, at the top of the episode, you know, you asked if there were any kind of like Britishisms that like we didn't understand. And yeah. I don't remember any specific ones, but I'm wondering if like subconsciously, like I would hear them and be like, I don't know what that meant, but it's probably just some British thing. And I just like forgot it.
In Tracy's case, he probably just says, I'm not bothered.
I wrote down a couple because I was just wondering, if, like, because I thought maybe I might forget as well. And then like, there's a bit where they say, oh, we're faffing around in the woods. You know,
is that just like walking around the woods, like playing around,
or like fucking around?
No, it's well, yeah, it's more like fucking around. You're like you're wasting time, you're faffing around, you're pissing around. Yeah,
okay.
So little things like that, maybe.
Context clues. Yeah. wait, give us some more. Do you have more?
Oh yeah, I have a couple. I guess some of them are quite obvious, but it's just so weirdly British. Like he calls them a soft tart.
Yes.
As an insult at one point, you know.
Yeah, like a sissy.
I mean, tart can also be like a slut, like you're being such a tart. But it's a very old-fashioned way to say it. You know, you wouldn't necessarily, if you said it to someone, it's not like a swear word. You wouldn't be like destroyed emotionally if that happened. But
right.
Out of curiosity, does it also have connotations to like a badly prepared pastry? Like, is it? Can you also interpret it literally, like nobody wants a soft tart?
Do you know, I never thought that, but I think absolutely. I think that's the way forward.
Holy, I mean, shit. I think tart is definitely more like, oh, you big slag or something like that.
Now, Joe, I'm the literal one, and like you that you just did that.
Look, I contain multitudes. I'm a very multifaceted person.
Good.
But what kind of tart would you want then if it's not soft? Like a firm tart?
Chewy?
Like,
chewy?
Crumbly?
Crumbly maybe.
Yeah, all of my cooking shows say crumbly.
Crumbly tart. To the mouth.
That's gross. No, I actually like softer things. Like when I always get the chewy Chips Ahoy cookies. I hate like the regular ones because I don't like crispy. I want soft baked goods.
Fair enough. Mm.
Not relevant to the conversation.
Pepperidge Farm.
Yeah.
I wanted to say I really, really loved the scene in the first episode at the end, you know, when the old lady is dragged down to the street. What did you guys think of
that? Oh, it's so good.
It's funny because it feels kind of like a one-off. Like, you're meant to... Like, I remember the first time I watched it, I thought, okay, so this is the cue that it's serious. Like, people are legitimately endangered if they're legitimately in danger if they don't cover themselves up, if they don't try to blend in. Like, this is what happens if ignorance and bigotry is allowed to run amok. Like, people will die, but it felt like a one-off. And then to see it come, again, full circle, like, I really can't praise the writing of the third episode and how well it pays off even incidental things from previous episodes. Mm. Because really, I feel like I had forgotten about that guy until Kieran discovers Rick's body and you see him looking at the window.
And you're like, put that in your back pocket.
Yeah, like, that seems meaningful.
Yeah, and it's interesting they don't really acknowledge it that much up until the end, but it still felt very natural.
Oh, yeah. Like,
had that through line.
And then you have that one guy that's like, you know, locked behind the gate, and he's like, whoa, man, like, sorry, like, leave me alone.
Oh, yeah.
I love that entire thing, because it would be really easy to dismiss that as just comic relief, because that character is such a joke. But, yeah. You know, it does a really good job of playing up some of the comedy, of just having this idiot be behind bars and the way that people treat him. But it also is such a sly commentary on, this is all it takes to switch from the side of being right, and I'm doing quotations that you can't see, and then being one of them, being the other. Like, oh, he got bitten, he's been put into quarantine, and all of a sudden, all of these people who know him just treat him like shit.
Right.
And he, yeah. Like, he nearly dies. I mean, I don't know that they play it up well enough, but, like, they just leave him in there, and then he could have died of his diabetes because he doesn't, no one helps him.
Yeah.
I think it's also really interesting because it shows how there's still so many misconceptions. Even though the uprising happened years before, people mm-hmm. still don't really fully understand the mechanics. And there's a lot of that the power of rumors in a village like that. And it kind of also sets up the whole scene with Lisa's parents. Although yes. I can't remember if it's before or after, but you know, it sets up that idea that they don't know either. And that's why they're so hopeful.
Yeah. Well, and why everyone is so fearful, because they fear the thing that they don't understand. It pays back what Amy was talking about at the rides as well, right?
Right. All right. Well, I think we're running a little long. So do y'all want to get any more yayas out about lingering thoughts on In the Flesh before we wrap up?
I would just say, I mean, I hope that people have obviously watched at least the first series. I'd love to hear what people thought of this if they went in not really knowing much about it, because I think it'd be really easy to have A, not heard of this, but B, just kind of dismiss it as like, oh, okay, it's just like a random zombie TV show. But I think to me, it's a really great indicator of the kinds of potential that long form narratives have for telling the kind of interesting genre stories that we don't often see.
Yeah.
Yeah. And done.
It was very thorough. I have nothing, literally nothing to add to that.
I know. I'm like, okay, cool. That's In the Flesh.
And also world peace.
But no, I mean, I agree. I think it's a very good show. I mean, I do want to watch the second series, and I'll probably get around to it eventually. Because again, only six episodes, so it's like, you know, at least half of a regular season for me. But yeah, I would recommend, if you, for some reason, if you've made it all the way through this episode and you haven't watched the first season series, go ahead and do that.
Thank you.
You'll get it one of these days, Trace.
Well, maybe. So before we get into what we're covering next week, David, this is a time where you can plug anything you want.
Well, I do have a couple of potential projects coming, but it kind of depends on some yeses from other people first. So I'm not... So, but yeah, basically I have nothing except to say, come find me on Twitter at DavidOpie, which is O-P-I-E, and I look forward to chatting with you. And thank you so much for having me, both of you, as well. I really appreciate it.
Of course.
Pleasure.
And, I mean, if you want, I can cut this out, but I believe congratulations are in order, because you are getting married soon.
Yes, that's a big project.
I don't know if it's too personal or not, so I mean, like, that's like, I can cut
that
out.
I mean... That's totally fine. No, yeah, I'm getting married next month, so I'm super excited. So,
yay,
yeah, so
that's
partly. Thank you so much. Yeah, so that's partly why things are all a bit up in the air, because I haven't had as much time to do work, and yeah, it's a lot going on. I'm going to get married in the Alps as well, which is just insane.
Oh my God, so jealous.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, it's all my fiance. Like, I'm just from this boring town in England.
But I will say, listeners, if you want some like top tier Austrian like landscape pornography, I strongly encourage you to follow David, because he regularly posts pictures of the countryside and it's absolutely stunning.
Alps porn.
Alps porn. Hashtag.
Hashtag Alps porn.
Oh man. Well, well, look at that. That's a good transition though, because if you would like to follow us on Twitter, you can reach me at Traced Thurman.
And I'm at B Stole My Remote. That's the letter B.
And if you're tweeting about the podcast, please be sure to use the hashtag horrorqueers in your tweets so we can find you, or you can email us at horrorqueers@gmail.com. If you have 2 seconds, please head over to iTunes and leave us a rating or a review if you have a little bit more time. And of course, if you like what you've listened to and want even more content, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/horrorqueers, where you can sign up for some exclusive bonus episodes. By the time this episode drops, we will have new episodes on Ari Aster's Midsummer. Ooh. And... Also dropping this week is our episode on Alexander Aja's Crawl.
Yay, Aquaticorp.
I'm so excited. Joe. Mm-hmm. It did, yeah. Joe, what are we covering next week?
All right, so we are leaving the British countryside behind. We are going to be diving into problematic child territory with Yom Colette Sarah's Orphan, which is celebrating its 10-year anniversary.
Yay! I'm excited for this one. I haven't seen it since theaters, so I'm intrigued to see how it holds up on a 10-year watch.
Yeah, it's still, yeah, batshit crazy. I watched it last year, and it's everything you remember and more.
Yay! Well, also, like, Vera Farmiga, before she really kind of blew up with, well, I mean, she's always been around, but, like, you know, like, I feel like that put her in the mainstream.
Yeah, it's a pre-Conjuring.
Yeah, exactly. Well, cool. Well, I guess we can cross out In the Flesh.
Yes, and cross out Horror Queer.
This episode was brought to you by the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network, delivering your weekly horror podcast fix. To find more episodes of this show and others, please visit bloodydisgusting.com/podcastnetwork.